We want to turn to former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, who is expected to drop out of the race for president after her Super Tuesday performance. We'll take her live now.
It is filled with followers, not leaders. Term limits for Washington politicians are needed now more than ever. Our world is on fire because of America's retreat. Standing by our allies in Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan is a moral imperative. But it's also more than that. If we retreat further, there will be more war, not less. As important, while we stand strong for the cause of freedom, we must bind together as Americans. We must turn away from the darkness of hatred and division. I will continue to promote all those values, as is the right of every American. I sought the honor of being your president, but in our great country, being a private citizen is privilege enough in itself. And that's a privilege I very much look forward to enjoying. In all likelihood, Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee when our party convention meets in July. I congratulate him and wish him well. I wish anyone well who would be America's president. Our country is too precious to let our differences divide us. I have always been a conservative Republican and always supported the Republican nominee. But on this question, as she did on so many others, Margaret Thatcher provided some good advice when she said, quote, "Never just follow the crowd. Always make up your own mind." It is now up to Donald Trump to earn the votes of those in our party and beyond it who did not support him. And I hope he does that. At its best, politics is about bringing people into your cause, not turning them away. And our conservative cause badly needs more people. This is now his time for choosing. I end my campaign with the same words I began it from the book of Joshua. I direct them to all Americans, but especially to so many of the women and girls out there who put their faith in our campaign. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged, for God will be with you wherever you go. In this campaign, I have seen our country's greatness. From the bottom of my heart, thank you, America. God bless you.
And that is Nikki Haley you're hearing. She is dropping out of the presidential race and issuing somewhat of a challenge to former President Donald Trump, saying it's up to you now to earn the votes of those who did not support you during the primaries. This, of course, happening as she only won one state in Super Tuesday.
Come share a word.
No, Spokane had a city song.
I know, it's crazy. That's where the world's heard. That's a very special theme song used in radio ads 50 years ago right now.
Yeah, how about that? So this is the 50th anniversary of Expo 74.
Hard to believe it's been 50 years already.
Yes, it is.
So, you know, that was a big deal when Spokane, little old Spokane, population 245,000, invited the world to the Inland Empire for Expo 74. Pretty amazing for a lot of reasons. There's all kinds of activities and special events planned for the anniversary. And there's a direct tie to presidential politics here on this, Super Wednesday today? The after Super Tuesday?
No, this is Ordinary Wednesday.
Okay, well, my favorite Expo expert is Bill Youngs. He's professor at Eastern Washington University over in Cheney. He authored the definitive history of Expo 74 called The Fair and the Falls. Little comparison here. So the theme in Seattle for the 62 World's Fair was Century 21. Very space age and futuristic at the time. But that style of futurism embodied by the Space Needle and the monorail, that sometimes can seem a little antiquated these days. Over in Spokane, they chose the environment and ecology as a theme for Expo 74, which seems almost timeless compared to Century 21. At least that's what I've been thinking lately. Now, Bill Youngs has done a lot of research about other fairs that have taken place since 1974. He told me that all of them have chosen a similar environmental theme. But 50 years ago, Spokane was the first.
By gosh, you've got Spokane, little old small city, isolated, but very much in the forefront of of celebrating and inquiring into the topic of environmentalism within a world fair. So we're quite proud of that.
You know, another thing they're proud of is that the town the size of Spokane could pull off a World's Fair. Now, back in the early 70s, the other city vying to be certified by this Bureau of Expositions in Paris that does the official certifying around that same time was Philadelphia, right? Huge city. They did the 1876 fair. Philadelphia ultimately backed out of their 1970s fair, but the leader of the Spokane fair, a guy named King Cole, told the Paris people Spokane was just forging ahead.
It underscores the fact that it was just so improbable that this small town could put it together. And I think it's really a study in civic leadership and the capacity of just the right persons at the right time to make something happen. Because if you were to look at it 100 years ago or 80 years ago and say, well, Spokane ever have a World Fair, I'm sure you'd say, I don't even want to think about that. That's never going to happen.
You know, the six-month carnival with all the rides and the entertainment, that's just part of it. It's more about the legacy of the fair. At least that's been the case in the Northwest. And it's common knowledge in Seattle, and maybe less so than it was a decade ago, that 62 fair, you know, transformed the city in every possible way, economically, culturally, civically, you name it. You know, created Seattle Center, of course. That led to Major League Sports with the Sonics playing in the old Coliseum. It gave civic leaders confidence and skills to attempt all kinds of other initiatives, like the big forward thrust ballot measure in the late 60s. Bill Young says in Spokane, the physical transformation that Expo 74 brought to downtown was an even bigger deal. Before the fair created Riverfront Park there, most of the Spokane River through town was covered in concrete and railroad bridges. The river was pretty much hidden away for decades. So that central location right on the now daylighted river became inseparable from Spokane's image, but also just from how people inhabit the core city.
Not to take anything away from the location of Century 21, now it's a lovely park, but it's basically a piece of ground, whereas there's a piece of ground, yes, in the case of Expo 74, but there's also a magnificent waterfall and rapids that had been almost totally forgotten in the years before. And now it's arguably the most dramatic urban riverfront anywhere in the country.
No, and Bill Youngs admits Expo 74 didn't make Spokane a major league city like Seattle, but it did lead to new infrastructure, and that's still paying off in the kind of events that Spokane attracts.
And we recently had the indoor collegiate championship of the whole country right here in Spokane. And these are the kinds of things that I think probably would never have happened without the kind of boost in confidence and know-how. It takes a huge amount of know-how to put together World Fair.
Now, I could talk to Bill Youngs for hours about World's Fair philosophies and legacies and everything. Now, his book, that The Fair in the Falls, he's got a new edition coming out later this month. Now, one of the first anniversary activities this year is the opening of a major new exhibit at the Museum of Arts and Culture. That's the MAC in Spokane in early May. Hannah Harbine is a curator there. She told me the MAC, they got all the archives and business papers and photo collections when the fair shut down. So this exhibit will have all kinds of pictures and posters and artifacts, too, like one of the gondolas from the Skyride and a nice assortment of souvenirs. And Anna says that while Expo 74 was the first environmentally focused World's Fair with an emphasis on taking care of the earth and the water and the sky, that didn't stop them from manufacturing several landfills worth of tchotchkes as fair souvenirs.
Ashtrays filled with jelly beans and send those to sponsors who had committed to help sponsor the fair and fund the fair. They have lapel pins. You'll see them everywhere in the thrift stores. They're kind of a staple. If you go thrifting, you'll usually see some sort of commemorative expo plate or an ashtray, a lot of ashtrays.
Same way that around here, you'd be at yard sales in the 70s and 80s, you'd always see the World's Fair glasses, full sets of them everywhere. You'd trip over them. Now, this last bit of audio is from Governor Dan Evans, who was in office during Expo 74. I interviewed him a decade ago for public TV. You might remember in 1974, this was the thick of the Watergate scandal. So it was a bit scandalous for some that President Richard Nixon was scheduled to speak at the opening ceremonies. Opening day was May 4th. This was just a few weeks after Congress had subpoenaed the White House for tape recordings of Oval Office meetings. The White House had only given transcripts. So there was a legal battle underway to get the actual audio as evidence in the impeachment inquiry. Air Force One landed at Fairchild Air Force Base, west of Spokane. Governor Evans and First Lady Nancy Evans, she recently passed away, they were there at Fairchild to greet the President and Mrs. Nixon. Governor Evans told me that they set up a little podium and a PA system right there at Fairchild next to Air Force One.
President Nixon got up and on the podium, and I introduced him with the simple statement, the President of the United States. And he turned to me and in a very clear voice said, "Thank you, Governor Evidence." And then he said, Evans. And, of course, the press corps nationally who were there could hardly contain themselves.
That's probably my favorite blooper of any kind in the history of the Pacific Northwest, maybe the world. Governor, and I always think of Governor Evans as Governor Evidence when I see him on TV. Now, the formal hearings, the impeachment inquiry began the following Thursday. This is right in the middle of the Nixon impeachment inquiry. And the weird thing about the fair is you had one president open it in person, President Nixon. And then when it came time to close down the fair in November, President Gerald Ford, he was there by tape, but he began the fair with one president. That had never happened before. I don't think it's ever happened since.
Wow.
So, big year over in Spokane celebrating that fair, the 50th anniversary of Expo 74.
Absolutely. Thank you, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
6:37, Seattle's Morning News. Renton police need help in locating a business owner who has now been missing for over a week. Let's go to news director Charlie Harger and Cairo reporter James Lynch.
Good morning, Dave and Colleen. Let me give you a sense of what happened behind the scenes. It's Tuesday morning in the Cairo newsroom. We get a call from Renton PD. They say, you guys might want to swing by here. We have a story. We need to get the word out. So we call up James. James, you are on your way to another story and realize really quickly we need to head to Renton. What did you find out?
Reina Hernandez is missing and has been missing since February 26. Now, this is a 57-year-old woman, a business owner. She owns a salon there, and her salon hasn't been open since the 26th. Family and friends haven't seen her or talked to her. She hasn't answered her phone. She hasn't returned pages. And police tell us today that they are pretty sure that her car is no longer in the area. They feel like she's a victim of foul play.
Police don't normally call us. There is something of concern to them when they say, hey, we need the eyes and ears on this story.
Exactly, because what they found is that this type of behavior is so out of character with her, that she is at her business on time throughout the day. Every day it's open. She constantly stays in touch with family here in the States as well as some other family in Mexico, and that she just wouldn't not go missing like that. She wouldn't not take phone calls, emails, and text messages. So they knew that something had to be wrong. Now, they called this press conference, and we were able to hear from Megan Black. Here's what she told us earlier.
Detectives have been following multiple leads. They have served many search warrants and uncovered evidence that leads us to believe that she was taken against her will.
Now, also what they say, they believe that that she was headed to a house where she used to live in Renton that morning. She talked to a friend and told her that she was out running errands and that she would be headed over to this house where she lived. Now, we don't know if she actually made it there or not. Police haven't released that information. What they have told us is that there were three men inside that house at the time she was supposed to have been there. They've talked to two of them, and one of them is not anywhere to be found. They want to talk to him. They think it's important that they talk to him, but they haven't been able to find him. He simply just disappeared as well. So they've got every detective that's available in their department on this story. They think it's a good possibility that she was abducted, and they want to find her as soon as possible.
And one thing I noticed about this, which is a little unusual, which indicates the severity of this story, they say call 911 right away. They don't say call the non-emergency line or some other way of contacting police. They want you calling 911 if you have any information.
Yes, they do, because they want to get this information, any new information, into the hands of detectives just as soon as they can.
Okay, we got to find Reina Hernandez, her picture, and more information at MyNorthwest.com.
That's News Radio's James Lynch and our news director, Charlie Harger. We head to Jerusalem, where CBS's Linda Gradstein has been stationed throughout the war. A proposal for a six-week ceasefire is now on hold between Israel and Hamas. And according to Linda, both sides are busy blaming each other.
Israel says that it won't move ahead until it gets a list of all of the hostages and who is still alive. There are about 134 hostages, and Israeli officials have said at least 31 of them are no longer alive. But Israel wants a list of who is alive. Hamas says it can't get that list until the ceasefire is put in place. Hamas also wants a promise from Israel that the six-week ceasefire is a permanent ceasefire, that the fighting won't start again after the 6 weeks. Now what's being talked about about is maybe a ceasefire of a few days to try to build confidence between the two sides. The Muslim holy month of Ramadan starts next Monday, and both Israel and the U.S. would like to see a ceasefire in place before then, but it's not, or starting then, but it's not clear yet if it's going to happen. At the same time, negotiations are still going on. Israel did not send a delegation to these negotiations, but the U.S., Qatar, and Egypt are negotiating and going kind of back and forth between Israel and Hamas to try to get a deal.
Do you have any sense of what Israel feels there is left to do, and just how much of Hamas remains?
Right. So, I mean, Israel has said that it has killed about 13,000 Hamas fighters out of a total of somewhere between 25 and 30,000. However, it has not managed to reach the top leadership of Hamas, including Yahya Sinwar, the head of Hamas, who is believed to be hiding underground in tunnels. When you ask what's still left to do, the big thing is the southern Gaza city of Rafah, which is near the Egyptian border. About 1.5 million Palestinians from the north of Gaza have moved to Rafah to escape the fighting. And Israel has said that it will launch a ground operation into Rafah. But the United States is really pressuring Israel not to do that until it can make sure that civilians won't be killed. So Israel still says it has work to do. It says that, you know, Hamas has a huge tunnel network underneath Gaza that goes for about 450 miles. Gaza is only 25 miles long.
Wow.
And Israel has blown up a lot of the tunnels, has tried to, get to the Hamas leadership, has killed a lot of Hamas soldiers, but has not managed to completely get rid of Hamas. And the thing is, it seems there are two goals. One is to make sure that Hamas can never pose a military threat, and the other is the freedom for the hostages. And it seems more and more clear that those two goals might actually be in opposition to each other.
Yeah. Does Hamas still have the ability to fire rockets into Israel?
It does, but at a much lower level. I mean, at the beginning of this conflict, tomorrow, by the way, is 5 months of war. And at the beginning, there were hundreds of rockets fired every single day. On October 7th, when Hamas started the war, there were thousands of rockets fired. And now it's more of an occasional kind of rocket. There have not been rocket sirens in Tel Aviv, for example, for a long time. Most of the rockets are in areas close to the border in Gaza, which in any case have been evacuated.
And the U.S. airdrops that we've been hearing about, are they effective or just a Band-Aid?
Oh, definitely just a Band-Aid. I mean, you're talking about Gaza has, 2.2 million people, and the U.S. airdrops, one was of 38,000 meals and one was of 32,000 meals. There was a huge shipment of flour that the United States has been trying to get into Gaza through the Israeli port of Ashdod, and there have been a lot of bureaucratic obstacles to that. And, the situation in Gaza is really growing very, very desperate. There are children actually dying of malnutrition every day.
And is Netanyahu aware of the level of protest in this country over the Biden administration's failure to move the needle here?
I'm sure he's aware of it. He's a very smart and savvy politician. You don't get to be Israel's longest serving prime minister by not being aware of it. That said, I think it's clear that he's putting his own interests, both his personal interests and what he thinks are the best, what he thinks are Israel's interests above what the United States thinks. For example, he has said repeatedly that he thinks military pressure will cause Hamas to release the hostages, that if Israel hits Hamas hard enough, it will release the hostages. While other Israeli analysts and security officials have said that the more pressure there is on Hamas, the less likely they are to release the hostages.
CBS correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Thank you, Linda.
Thank you.
Right now, we are going to basically try to save your life, maybe, by bringing some awareness to a sometimes uncomfortable subject, that being colorectal cancer. It is, in fact, Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. I know something about this because colon cancer was my dad's last battle. And it's important to catch it early on. I talked with Dr. Leila Rashidi, who's a colorectal surgeon with MultiCare at Tacoma General Hospital.
I think colorectal cancer is rising, especially in young population. Unfortunately, it doesn't always have signs and symptoms. So getting screened, especially early, it's very, very important because number one, you can prevent it. You can find the polyps that are not cancerous yet and remove it. So both it's important for diagnostic, but also treatment at the same time if they're found precancerous. And if you find it, hopefully if you get screened soon enough, you can treat it. And there's great treatments out there right now for colorectal cancer.
Is there a way to prevent it? Because that'd be the best solution, right? If you could figure out what causes most colorectal cancers?
Absolutely. So prevention is actually by making that diagnosis, right? You want to find it before it's a cancer. And there are different modalities that you can get screened for colorectal cancer. The gold standard, we always say, and right now the U.S. Preventative Task Force recommends age 45 to do your colonoscopy on a patient with average risk. But if you have risk factors or any symptoms, we recommend to get screened earlier. There are other modalities as well. If you don't have, the man to do colonoscopy or you're in an area that you can't, such as, the guaiac-based fecal occlusion blood test, which is pretty much detects blood in a stool. There are other modalities like flexible sigmoidoscopy or the fecal immunochemical test as well. So talk to your primary care doctor or to your gastroenterology and see what, is best for you.
Those tests that involve mailing in a sample, are those reliable?
They're good. They're sensitive. And I would say, yes, you want to, it's one way to detect it. Is it specific? Not always. So, but it's a great test. It's easy. They send you a kit and, you test at home, you send it back, to the lab. And if they find anything, that's when they recommend for you to do colonoscopy. So it can definitely help with prevention.
Now, should the test come back positive, what's the procedure then? Can it be solved with simple surgery or is it more extensive?
Once it comes back positive, that's when we recommend to undergo colonoscopy. Because with colonoscopy, you can see the entire colon and evaluate the lining of the bowel, look for any polyps, for any masses, and detect if anything bad is in the colon. So that would be the next step. And then based on the colonoscopy finding, we'll see if this is something that should be treated with surgery or if it needs further evaluation.
We are hearing from Dr. Leila Rashidi. She's a colorectal surgeon at MultiCare, Tacoma General Hospital. And one of the questions I asked her was, when you finally treat the cancer, how likely is it to come back after surgery?
If you can treat it with, if you find it early enough with surgery, you're taking the cancer out. And their great technology has gone so much better. We treat a lot of our, colorectal cancer patients. And to be honest with you, patients do very well with the technology. There's minimal invasive surgery technology, such as laparoscopic, mm-hmm. robotics, which, most of our patients go home, in selected patients same day or next day. And once it's out, based on the final pathology, we'll see if any further, treatment needed. But usually the surveillance for colorectal cancer is for 5 years.
Hmm. I know that once my dad was diagnosed, it came back as it was stage four. So it ended up being too late. But what I do remember is that the chemotherapy they put him through was terrible. It was my sister felt it was almost worse than the disease. Have things improved since then?
Yes, there's been a lot of improvement in how, medically we also treat with, chemotherapy and for certain cases in colon and in rectal cancer with radiation. So this is definitely, your medical oncology and radiation oncology will talk to you about. But like I mentioned, there has been so much advancement in treatment of colorectal cancer. So I always tell my patients, cancer is a team approach, mm-hmm. and the patient is the center. So they're pretty much, I call it the captain. They're the center of a team and we're around them. So it's a true multidisciplinary approach. And each, you know, section will talk to you about how it can be treated. And yes, I'm not sure when your father was diagnosed, but even during the past 5 years, there's been so much, you know, improvement in the management of colorectal cancer.
Well, that's good to hear. And the bottom line is the screening is well worth it because there are cures. And again, the importance, and you can't emphasize it enough, is just to catch it early.
Absolutely. I think, you know, the myth that young people will not get colorectal cancer, to be honest, is not true. I would say anyone with, you know, rectal bleeding or change in bowel habits, doesn't matter you're 20, you're 45, or you're over that, age is not a factor anymore. You definitely want to talk to your primary care and get the appropriate, you know, screening or diagnosis to find out if you have anything bad in your colon.
Dr. Leila Rashidi is a colorectal surgeon at Tacoma General. Thank you, Dr. Rashidi.
Thank you.
It's time now for your daily dose of kindness. It's brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. A library in Worcester, Massachusetts, has come up with a unique way to relieve library late fees. The Worcester Public Library announced all you have to do is show them your cat. Through the end of March, people who have lost or damaged library books can bring a picture, drawing, magazine clipping, anything you'd like. They just want to see cats, and librarians will reactivate their library cards. Oh, they're awash with kittens. The New York Times reports the program is called March Meowness. In the first few days, the program has helped get hundreds of books returned, 400 to be exact. And now library branches have a growing mural of cat pictures. The library noted that since the pandemic, many people have not returned from the isolation and back to the public library. They're encouraging people to act meow and return to the glory days of the public library.
And now from the G and Ursula Show, here he is, G Scott.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
Some big names, more big names leaving the Seahawks, yeah. And it's starting to sound like they're not just refacing the cabinets. It's like a total rebuild here.
Right. Yeah. So there's three big names that happened. Let's just go through them. The first one is Will Dissly, tight end for the Seattle Seahawks. I think one of the biggest reasons why he was let go has nothing to do with maybe his skill set, because he's a really good football player. I think it had to be with his contract. His contract was a little big. It's a little fat, you know what I mean? And so I, of the three that were released yesterday, I actually can see Will Dissly coming back possibly.
Really?
Maybe with, I mean, it's a possibility, right? If I had to bet, if there was three of those three, he'd be the one to come back because, look, good dude, great locker room dude, really good player. One of the biggest reasons why I think that happened was because of the money, the big salary. But he could possibly come back on a reduced, restructured
do they do
salary.
That? He can say, I'd like to stay. I'll take less money to stay.
I mean, you could do that before and restructure it, or you can do it after, right? Just let's just see what the market is out there for him. And free agency period starts on Monday. And there's some other teams that are like, hey, we want you. Come on, bring your stuff. Bring your sleeping bag and all that kind of stuff. If that's what they want, then he'll go. But I can see Will Dissly possibly coming back. I like Will Dissly. The next one was Quandre Diggs. Quandre Diggs is the player that I was the most shocked that the Seahawks released yesterday. He's a really good player. For the amount of money that he makes, he gives you that and more.
This idea that they were paying way too much for the safeties like him?
Well, so that's kind of what's being talked about. Yeah. And I'm going to get to the other safety in a second. I'm saving him for last.
Gotcha.
But DeQuandre Diggs, great safety on the field, off the field, in the locker room. He's loved. I've texted with a lot of former players and some current players that were kind of shocked to see DeQuandre Diggs get cut. This is going to be a tough one, and I'll overall get to that in a second. Now, the last safety, he was gone yesterday. Jamal Adams, one things kind of fizzled out the way that it did towards the end of the season. He did play a little bit hurt, no doubt about that. He had some injuries. But the Jamal Adams was probably the one that I most expected on the team that would not be back this next season coming up. No doubt about that. Now, back to what you were talking about with the safeties. Yes, there has been a lot of money invested into the safeties for the Seahawks. And it's going to be, in my opinion, it's going to be tough when you just release two starting safeties that were your starting safeties, and then next year, what is going to be your plan? I feel in my heart, if that's what's happened, I think that the plan might be to get a free agent to come in here, because I don't think that you would bank on some rookies that you would draft in a draft coming in and filling that role. So we'll see. If that does happen, I'll be on your show to talk about it. But I do feel in my heart that the Seahawks might go and get a free agent safety.
Is this the development you were talking about when somebody videotaped you on the plane?
Huh? No.
Oh,
so I told everybody what that was about. No, the development was I was on the phone with KJ, and I was talking about him getting ready to be the 49ers assistant linebackers coach, and I wasn't thinking, and the person next to me on the plane was recording, and that's why I was kind of so mad. And so I didn't want that information to go before it became public.
So everybody in the plane could hear you discussing what was clearly some inside information.
No, I wasn't talking that loud.
Okay.
I wasn't talking that loud, but we were on the tarmac. The plane was delayed. And you know what? How about this?
Yeah.
I was more mad at myself than I was at the person that was recording me.
Has anyone ever
recorded you, Dave?
No, they don't care what I say. It's when you mishandle those classified documents that you get yourself in trouble. I'm just telling you.
Yeah. How about my laptop?
Don't lose that thing.
Yeah. Sully, they got Max Tolls out here?
Yeah. Maximum. I'm changing my name.
What did you change it to?
Max Toll.
We're going to check in with our legislative reporter, Car News Radio's Matt Markovich. And despite lawmakers saying that they're working well with members across the aisle, it turns out there's still a little partisanship going on. Here's Matt.
Oh, yeah, it's alive and well. Good morning, Dave. 2 days left. Tomorrow is the last day of the short session for this year. The House worked late in the night last night, passing a controversial bill affecting the future of natural gas in the state. We'll have more on that later today. But what's going on right now, there's a lot of horse trading going on behind the scenes as the budgets haven't been passed and they should be voted on tomorrow. You know, I'll take that if you take this. That kind of thing is happening. But despite most of the bills passing in with near unanimous support, you may not realize that, by Democrat and Republican lawmakers in Olympia, many final votes at the legislature are seeing this partisan divide and falling along party lines. And roughly 80 bills were passed yesterday by members of the House and Senate. All of them are heading to the governor's desk for his approval. Hundreds of bills have passed in similar fashion over the last 2 weeks or so. And that's what I wanted to talk about, kind of point out what happened yesterday and talk about this partisan divide. For example, you just had a little story about the stripper Bill of Rights. That's Senate Bill 6105. Yesterday, it passed along a party line vote, 29-20, with Democrats in the majority in the Senate. Prior to that, the House Democrats passed an amended version along a party line vote as well, 58-36. Here's the bill's sponsor, Democratic State Senator Rebecca Saldana.
This is really important and will raise the standards to make sure that no one under 21 is in these facilities, making sure that there's actually safety and security and a lot of additional new training for all the people that work in this facility.
It also requires the Washington State Liquor and Cannabis Board to repeal the lewd laws governing bars and businesses that have a liquor license. Now, the move opens the door for alcohol to be served at strip clubs. But Republican State Senator Curtis King said House Democrats did a near total rewrite of Saldana's bill and urged a no vote.
We have grave concerns over the preemption of local authority. We've received letters and concerns from the City of Seattle's attorney that they are against this bill. We've received the same from King County prosecutors that they're against this bill.
So a party line vote ensued, and the stripper Bill of Rights is headed to the governor with all that Democratic support. Now, again, yesterday, a partisan divide could be seen in the bill that we've talked about before that bans banning books in schools. Several states have been passing laws banning books in schools that address the history of the LGBTQ community. And to prevent that from happening, Democrats in the legislature pushed this bill forward. It's House Bill 2331. It prohibits public school districts from refusing to approve or prohibit books that relate to or include the study of the role of contributions of any individual or group that is part of a protected class. The most controversial aspect involves who decides which materials should be accepted or banned. Now, the bill says it's up to the district superintendent, following yet unwritten guidelines established by the state superintendent of public instruction, and not the local school board. House Republican floor leader Jim Walsh, Republican of Auburn, Aberdeen, said changes made by the Senate Democrats prevent parents represented by the school board members from being involved in the decision process.
Proposals like those made across the rotunda, which limit parents' access and their voice in these processes, hurt the overall effectiveness of our efforts to provide that high-quality basic education to all children around the state, regardless of creed or color or background.
And Representative Monica Girardeau-Stonier, she's a Democrat from Vancouver and the bill sponsor and a teacher in the Evergreen Public Schools District, said the bill gives parents the ability to contact a teacher before a class begins to suggest alternatives to books that the parents find objectionable.
And this bill requires that that be honored. But on the flip side, if I as a parent believe that a set of texts ought to be available for my child to have access to and to read, it honors my request that they have access to diverse titles as well.
And it's going to the governor's desk after all House and Senate Democrats voted for it and all the Republicans voted against it. And guns have always been a regular party line vote. It happened again yesterday. House Bill 2118 adds requirements for gun shop owners to protect their gun stock from theft by installing high definition cameras and recording devices and additional paperwork to be made available to authorities. Now, gun shop owners testify that all these requirements are expensive, time consuming, and unnecessary because fewer than 2% of the gun thefts in the state occur at gun shops. And some gun shop owners testified in committee that the bill would put the gun shops out of business. Here's Jim Walsh again.
When, by millimeter and millimeter and millimeter, we restrict the ability of the law-abiding people to protect themselves, we commensurately empower criminals to behave in a criminal way. In its search for common sense, this proposal goes the opposite direction.
But the Democratic majority in the House passed the bill 56-39. Senate made some changes, and then the Senate passed it with just one Democrat joining all the Republicans voting against it. And we just had the vote on the open carry of weapons at zoos, aquariums, libraries, and bus stops and transit centers. Both that bill passed the House and Senate straight party line vote with all Democrats voting for the location ban and all the Republicans saying no. And all this partisanship was brought up yesterday by the House Minority Leader, Drew Stokesbury. He's a Republican from Auburn, during a media availability to reporters.
The people we represent, most of them don't care if something is a Republican idea or a Democratic idea. They just care if it's a good idea. We should have less of this rigid voting by caucus and allow folks to vote their more often.
And Stokesbury accused the minority of Democrats, roughly a group of 20, controlling all the votes of the 58 House Democrats. And he pointed to the votes on the three initiatives on Monday, where the Democrats, he says, were allowed to vote their conscience, and a majority of them joined the Republicans in making all those three initiatives law.
For all the concerns we hear about the death of democracy at the federal level, allowing a portion of one caucus to unilaterally block common sense bills that 70% of Washingtonians want, that's a threat to democracy. Thankfully, the initiative was able to break through that roadblock, and a lot of this is possible when folks are free to vote their conscience rather than being kept in lockstep with caucus leadership.
And finally, Dave, just a surprise yesterday. Democrat and Republican lawmakers got rid of the partisan divide and agreed on a gun-related bill. Huh. Republicans, which are always opponents of gun restrictions, joined Democrats for Senate Bill 6246, which prohibits a person claiming to be incompetent to stand trial from owning a firearm. It also prohibits the court from restoring firearm rights to a person who lost their rights due to involuntary commitment for mental health treatment. And guess what? 34-15 in the Senate, 84-11 in the House. they broke ranks and on a gun bill. So surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
On all these bills, be heading to the governor's desk for his signature.
Matt Markovich. Thank you, Matt.
You're welcome, Dave.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.